This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. I'm glad to have your company, and I hope you'll stick around as we review this week's WMRA and statewide news. Virginia Public Radio's Sandy Hausman takes a deep look at Dominion Power's new plans for the future, and we've got a new report of waste in the state's Medicaid spending. WMRA's Jesse Nadler takes a look at the chemical in sunscreen that may be killing the ocean's coral reefs. And we've got Our Island Universe to take us far into space and far back in time to the Big Bang. But first, earlier this year, a Charlottesville woman opened her home to students interested in learning roots music, bluegrass, folk, acoustic blues. Now, to her family's relief, the lessons have moved out of their home and into a bona fide music school because interest in that little program far exceeded her expectations. WMRA's Emily Richardson Lorente recently spent an afternoon there.
The Front Porch Roots Music School doesn't actually have a front porch, but the music here is reminiscent of music you might have heard on front porches in Virginia a century or two ago.
I want it to be fun, and I want people to feel like they're learning something that feels really valuable to them.
Emily Roby Morrison runs the Front Porch. She's happy to talk about how music brings people together and the important role it plays in our culture. But there's another more practical reason she started the nonprofit earlier this year.
I started learning how to play the banjo when I was about 35 and became acutely aware of how mortifying it is to go to a jam and have no idea what you're doing. So it was sort of like I wanted to start something that I wanted for myself when I was a new banjo student in Charlottesville.
And Emily got what she wanted. The Front Porch now offers private lessons in banjo, dulcimer, mandolin, and a variety of other instruments traditionally used in roots music.
How about that? That's pretty good. First shot.
It's also offering about a dozen group classes, from a folk choir for kids to something called new old-time guitar. Many of those classes are held in the large, sun-filled living room on the first floor. Here, students will find a comfy couch covered in a handmade quilt, a grand piano, whimsical animal paintings on the wall by Colombian artist Ali Sullivan, and a circle of folding chairs.
We ought to just go ahead and play it.
At the moment, one of the Front Porch's 17 teachers is sitting on one of those chairs. Pete Vigor is leading an intermediate fiddle class.
That's first phrase.
Pete says someone who wanders off the street into the Front Porch might feel a little confused at first.
Because there are people milling around and chatting in the living room and making a sandwich in the kitchen and other people playing and other people trying to have a private lesson. It's a little more informal way to teach and learn music.
Same thing again.
One of the fiddlers learning here today is 11-year-old Will Tillman.
It's very entertaining, I have to say, and I really like it, so.
If you had to describe the Front Porch to one of your friends who was thinking about taking music lessons, how would you describe it?
You may think it will take up your time, but it really doesn't. And when you're done, you're just like, wow, we did that much in just so little time, and you get to learn a lot.
Will's actually not the youngest student in this class today. 7-year-old Pachi had a private lesson with Pete Vigor earlier, then stuck around to join the fiddle class. Pachi is a small man of few words. What do you think of Mr. Vigor?
Pretty good.
What do you like best about him?
Everything, basically.
And what's it like to come here for classes?
Fun, I guess.
Okay, here we go.
Pachi's mom, Michelle Bonham, has more to say on the matter.
Well, you know, I bring him here because he's got a great teacher, and I think that really makes a difference in playing and having that motivation to want to continue to play after, you know, the first month where it can be kind of hard to get kids to practice.
Adults, too, for that matter. In today's class, the kids are learning fiddle side by side with a young professional woman and an older woman of, let's say, indeterminate age. That mix of ages is one of the many features that sets the Front Porch apart from other music schools.
We have as many adults as we have children taking lessons here. And we have absolute beginners of all ages to students who have been playing for 25, 30 years who are interested in refining their skills and becoming more fluent on their instrument of choice.
Hand me down my walking cane.
After the lessons end in the living room, an evening jam session begins there. There's half a dozen grown-ups in attendance, along with a couple of kids. Their dad, Seth Morrison, is the guy on the big bass violin.
I can't think of any place else where I would be able to sit around with my 9 and 11-year-old, and they could play whatever they want to play and feel at home with the people here.
And that's maybe the best thing about the front porch. At a time when each of us can easily customize our own music channel on Pandora or Spotify, and a family car trip may involve a set of earbuds and a separate MP3 player for each passenger, the idea of learning, making, and enjoying music together is, well, kind of old school. John Frazee jamming here on the mandolin gets it.
So much different than playing, you know, alone by yourself. It's been really great. This is a really special place.
For WMRA News, I'm Emily Richardson Lorente.
Even though we're heading into winter, it's a good time to think about sunscreen. A new study finds that the sunscreen most of us slather on at the beach contains an ingredient that is killing coral reefs around the world. The lead author of the study lives in Amherst County, and WMRA's Jesse Nadler spoke to him to get the lowdown on the shady side of sunscreen.
A main ingredient in more than 3,500 sunscreen products is a chemical called oxybenzone. The personal care industry loves it because it's one of the few available sunscreen ingredients that protects skin from both ultraviolet A rays, which age the skin, and ultraviolet B rays, which burn. You can find it in brands ranging from Copper Tone to L'Oreal Paris to Hawaiian Tropic. It's also found in lipstick, mascara, and shampoo. But there's a less than sunny component to all this amazing sun protection. Oxybenzone is destroying coral reefs around the globe. This is according to a study published last month in the journal Archives of Environmental Contamination and Toxicology. The study's lead author is Dr. Craig Downs of Hereticus Environmental Laboratory in Clifford, Virginia.
We did the study in response to a forensic investigation of why coral reefs were dying in the Caribbean, specifically within the Virgin Islands National Park. And at several of the sites, we didn't have a very good explanation of what was killing the coral reef.
Coral is called the rainforest of the ocean. It's critical for biodiversity and the environmental health of aquatic life. It contributes billions of dollars each year to local economies through tourism and fishing. The Caribbean has lost 80% of its coral reefs in the last 50 years, according to Dr. Downs, due in part to rising ocean temperatures. That's been linked to what is known as bleaching, which is when coral expels algae, turning it completely white, then dies. But researchers suspected some kind of pollutant was also hastening coral's demise. A local vendor on the Caribbean island of St. John overheard Dr. Downs and his team discussing the issue. The vendor approached them and said, "It's the tourists. Just wait and see what they leave behind."
And if you head down to the beach around 4:30, 5 o'clock after all the tourists leave, you can see a nice sheen of, looks like an oil slick on the surface of the water. So we measured the level of certain chemical sunscreen compounds in the water, and we were surprised to see high concentrations of several sunscreen compounds, and one of these was oxybenzone.
The study determined that it takes only a tiny amount of sunscreen to damage the coral, the equivalent of a single drop of water in 6.5 Olympic-sized swimming pools. They also determined how oxybenzone destroys the reef.
Oxybenzone is an endocrine disruptor.
It damages the coral's DNA, causing deformities and inhibiting its ability to reproduce. It also alters the way organisms grow. Researchers suspect oxybenzone has something to do with why male fish, such as bass, have been developing female organs. The European Union has already listed oxybenzone on its list of substances that are of great concern and need to be replaced. The chemical has also been linked to bleaching. Dr. Downs repeated similar results in Hawaii, but because research for the study was only conducted on two sites, the Virgin Islands and Hawaii, detractors say it's too early to draw definitive conclusions. In a press release issued 2 days after the study's publication, the Personal Care Products Council, which is a trade organization of 600 cosmetic and personal care product companies, issued a statement saying that, quote, "This conclusion is based upon research conducted under laboratory conditions," unquote. This isn't technically accurate. Dr. Downs conducted his research in the field. The press release goes on to say that coral is being damaged by all sorts of factors, global warming, unsustainable fishing practices, and that oxybenzone shouldn't be singled out. They warn that this study may result in fewer people wearing sunscreen, which is a concern given that there are nearly 68,000 new cases of melanoma, the deadliest form of skin cancer, resulting in more than 9,000 deaths every year. But the takeaway from Dr. Downs is fairly straightforward.
Everyday folks can help prevent the pollution of their environments by using personal care products that don't contain threatening chemicals.
He recommends using non-nano zinc oxide and non-nano titanium oxide sunscreens instead. For WMRA News, I'm Jesse Nadler.
You'll find a list of safe sunscreens and those that contain oxybenzone that you might want to avoid at WMRA.org. Now to news out of Richmond earlier in the week, where lawmakers heard a report saying Virginia is likely spending millions in state-funded health care for people who don't actually qualify for the benefits. Virginia Public Radio's Mallory Nopane has more.
There's no specific number for how much Virginia is spending on Medicaid that it shouldn't, but there is an estimate for one aspect of the program that gives officials a sense. To be eligible for Medicaid, you have to reapply every year, and there's a huge backlog of those reapplications.
And so logically, some of those individuals are going to be ineligible, but they're just not getting checked until later.
Jeff Lenardi is in charge of the state's review of Medicaid. He and his team combed through those applications for 1 year.
And our estimate indicated that between about $21 million and $38 million was spent on those individuals who were late and were ineligible but hadn't been checked yet. And that's state and federal funds, so about half of that is state funds.
It's difficult to qualify for Medicaid in Virginia. Low-income parents, children, pregnant or disabled people can get health care through the program, but very poor adults cannot. Then there are income requirements, which may seem cut and dry.
However, the income that you receive that counts toward that and the actual threshold relative to federal poverty has a lot of variables involved.
For instance, veterans benefits or child support. Neither counts as part of your income. And the threshold depends on how many people are in your household, which for children who compose half of Medicaid recipients in the state can be complicated.
So yes, the line in the sand, so to speak, of what the criteria is simple, but understanding all the circumstances of an individual and how that relates to that criteria is complicated.
And if someone reports their income as zero, the state doesn't verify it at all.
State policy just directs the eligibility worker to take that at face value, essentially what the client says.
This is the first part of a multi-year review of Virginia's Medicaid, coming at a time when the program is under close political scrutiny. Democratic Governor Terry McAuliffe has led efforts to get more people covered under Medicaid, which would be mostly paid for with federal dollars through the Affordable Care Act. But those attempts have stalled quickly in Virginia's Republican-controlled legislature, which has instead focused on reducing the cost of the program. In Richmond, I'm Mallory Nopane.
Last month, Dominion Power offered its annual report to the state explaining how it intends to supply affordable and reliable energy over the next 15 years. Virginia Public Radio's Sandy Hausman reports that by 2030, this state will be getting less than 10% of its power from renewables and might be constructing another nuclear reactor.
Dominion came up with four possible scenarios for the future, each putting emphasis on a different fuel source. The cheapest was the solar plan, but Senior Vice President Tom Wolfarth says the company would have to cover a lot of land.
If you're talking about 4,000 megawatts, that's 32,000 acres, which is roughly the size of the city of Richmond.
Solar sites would be spread across the state in relatively flat areas close to places where they could connect to the grid. Dominion's identified dozens of possibilities. But Wolfarth admits the solar plan would only get 6% of the state's power from the sun. 60% of our electricity would come from burning gas and coal. Now, Dominion is building a plant in Maryland to liquefy and export gas, prompting some to wonder if the price of that fuel might spike at home. Wolfarth doesn't think so.
Just because there is such an abundant amount of natural gas.
The wind plan, dubbed the most expensive, envisions 8% of our energy coming from solar panels and offshore turbines by 2030. That baffles David Carr, a senior attorney at the Southern Environmental Law Center. He notes Virginia has ideal conditions for offshore wind, and Rhode Island is already building a wind park.
The Block Island project has been under construction this summer. They built the foundations. They're going to put the turbines up next summer, and the project will be running next year.
Dominion knows that, but points out that people on Block Island are now generating power from diesel fuel, spending 37 cents a kilowatt hour, compared with Dominion's current charge of 11 cents. Which brings us to the nuclear option. About as expensive, Wolfarth says, as offshore wind, the advantage is that nuclear is more reliable.
You turn the keys and the nuclear power plant starts operating and you're adding zero carbon, but you're adding a lot of megawatt hours.
Which explains why Dave Carr at the Southern Environmental Law Center sees Dominion spending big bucks to plan a third nuclear reactor at North Anna and a pittance to plan offshore wind.
You can just look at the dollar flow and see that Dominion is spending over $500 million on the third reactor at North Anna, and they've spent $5 to $10 million on offshore wind.
Some environmentalists wish the utility would put greater emphasis on conservation. Consultant Michael Schneider, for example, argues demand for electricity is going down in Europe.
We see now electricity consumption actually declining for several years in a row, pretty similar to the United States, where the consumption peaked already a few years ago as well.
But Wolfarth figures demand for power in Virginia will rise more than 1% per year, in part because energy-intensive data centers love to locate in the northern part of this state.
Because of the low cost of our electricity, because of the proximity to the federal government.
The bottom line, Dominion sees no more than 8% of its power coming from renewable sources by 2030. And nuclear remains a real option in spite of what happened at Fukushima, and more recently an underground fire that some feared might threaten a nuclear waste storage facility in St. Louis. I'm Sandy Houseman.
After a tsunami created a nuclear crisis in Japan, Germany announced plans to phase out its nuclear plants, and France, which now gets three-quarters of its power from nuclear reactors, recently said it would reduce its reliance to 50%. Here in Virginia, though, Dominion Power is giving serious thought to expanding its nuclear capacity. In a follow-up report, Sandy Houseman talked with experts who have doubts about that plan.
Faced with federal regulations that will limit air pollution from burning of coal, oil, and gas, Dominion says it will up its reliance on wind and solar power, getting up to 8% of its energy from those renewable sources by 2030. Future plans call for generation of up to half of Dominion's electricity from natural gas and at least a quarter from nuclear plants near Norfolk and Richmond. What's more, the company could build a third reactor at North Anna at an estimated cost of $20 billion. Paris-based energy consultant Michael Schneider is surprised. There are 60 reactors being built around the world, he says, but three-quarters of them are behind schedule.
There's only five reactors under construction in the United States, all of them being delayed. In fact, Watts Bar 2 in Tennessee has started construction in 1973.
One problem he cites is a lack of expertise.
The United States, the last reactor, dates from 1996 in Tennessee. So we don't have the skilled workforce and managers and decision makers that have experience to deal with those large projects.
Without an experienced team, he says, quality control is a real issue. Security may also be a problem. In France, drones have been seen buzzing nuclear power plants. And at the Union of Concerned Scientists, David Lochbaum thinks federal regulators need to look at that.
Because the security measures that were ordered by the NRC after 9/11 considered suicide aircraft, but drones really weren't out there as they are today.
He also thinks this country must find a better way to dispose of radioactive waste from existing plants before building new reactors.
The federal government has yet to come up with a place for spent fuel to go, and as a result, spent fuels stacked up everywhere at plant sites where it's not supposed to be.
Safety aside, there might be financial reasons for Dominion to pull back from plans for a new reactor. The price of renewable energy is coming down, but the cost to build nuclear is rising. Again, independent consultant Michael Schneider.
Construction cost estimates have skyrocketed over the past 10, 15 years, but it's also increasingly expensive to operate these things.
Dominion has signaled its continued support for nuclear energy. At a White House conference last week, the company announced it would become the first utility in the nation to request a second 20-year extension on its license to operate the Surrey plant near Norfolk. Schneider thinks that's crazy.
You know, if a reactor has operated for 40 years, it means it has been designed 50 years ago. That's in the 1960s. Geez, in the 1960s, that was a different technology age altogether.
But UVA Professor Houston Wood sees nothing inherently wrong with older technology.
Air Force One is still a 747.
Dominion fired up its first reactor at Surrey in 1972 with an assurance that it could operate safely for 40 years. If the Nuclear Regulatory Commission says okay, the plant could continue to supply power until it turns 80. I'm Sandy Houseman.
I'm Chanel Verani, and this is Our Island Universe. In the 1920s, Edwin Hubble discovered that spiral nebula, external galaxies like our own, are moving away from us. In that moment, the expanding universe was born. That the universe is expanding is consistent with the Big Bang, but is that all the evidence there is for the event that launched the universe? In fact, there are several independent lines of evidence. The first is the expanding universe discovered by Hubble. The second is the composition, or what the universe is made up of. Most of it is hydrogen, helium, and trace amounts of lithium, the first three elements on the periodic table. The conditions in the first 3 minutes after the Big Bang match the conditions inside a star, where it converts hydrogen into helium. By measuring the ratios of hydrogen, helium, and other trace elements, the observations match the predictions of a Big Bang. The smoking gun evidence, however, is the microwave background radiation, the relic radiation from the Big Bang. Discovered in the 1960s and exquisitely measured in the 1990s, the background radiation tells us the universe was created 13.8 billion years ago, and we know that age to better than 1% accuracy. What caused the Big Bang? Don't have a clue. Ain't science grand?
I am Chanel Verani, director of the John C. Wells Planetarium in Harrisonburg, Virginia.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Bib and Dolly Frazier, Eugene Stoltzfus Architects, Joy Loving, Janet Trettner, an anonymous donor, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of Harrisonburg and Rockingham County. But we could use your help, too. Find out more about how you can contribute to the News and Information Fund at WMRA.org, where you'll also find all of our stories from the newsroom. Be sure to like us on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio, and you can follow me on Twitter at WMRA News. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's News Director and Morning Edition host. I'll talk to you in the morning. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.